Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think there is some stigma still attached to the farming life, and it's one that we need to overcome.
Michael Simmons is a member of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. He talks about why honoring farmers was an important line to include in the new food charter. We have a Q&A with journalist Michael Moss this show about how rural infrastructure promotes growing corn over fruits and veggies. Chef Daniel Orr had some help picking sour cherries from his neighbor's tree. He turns them into a refreshing drink for us. And we get an update on the avian flu outbreak on Midwest poultry farms from Harvest Public Media. And farmer Jeff Padgett talks about keeping pastures hearty and healthy for his grazing animals. What's happening in food news? Lou Ann Johnson with details.
Last week, it was Chipotle announcing it will remove GMO ingredients from its recipes. Before that, McDonald's said it would stop selling chicken raised with human antibiotics. And the latest menu tweaking announcement comes from Panera. CEO Ron Shaich explained that by the end of 2016, the company will remove various artificial colors and flavors, sweeteners, and meat treated with antibiotics from its menus. It's 150 items in total. Food policy experts are divided on Panera's announcement. New York University professor Marion Nessel applauds Panera, while others, like Michael Jacobson, executive director from the Center for Science in the Public Interest, questions the motives. Jacobson argues companies should focus more on refined white flour and high calorie counts. Panera joins at least 12 other food companies in the past 6 months who have pledged to remove various ingredients. Another announcement from McDonald's this week, more about business than about food, the fast food giant will restructure globally. Steve Easterbrook has taken the reins as CEO after Don Thompson stepped down earlier this year. Easterbrook announced that McDonald's will focus its new global restructuring plan on four main groups: the U.S., international lead markets, high growth markets, and foundational markets. Part of the change will include refranchising 3,500 company-owned restaurants by the end of 2018. Franchises would then account for 90% of McDonald's restaurants globally. McDonald's has had its share of troubles over the past year, including global food scandals and steep sales declines. And edible insect proponents have touted insects as an untapped source of protein for a food-insecure world. An FAO report in 2013 said that crickets need 12 times less feed than cattle, 4 times less feed than sheep, and half as much feed as pigs and broiler chickens to produce the same amount of protein. The bad news is that a new study has thrown into question whether edible insects, in this case crickets, could be raised in large enough numbers to make a dent in the looming global food crisis. In a study published in the online journal PLOS One, researchers at the University of California Division of Agriculture and Natural Resources and the University of California, Davis, raised common house crickets on 5 different diets. Some ate chicken feed, some ate a mixed salad of food waste and crop residue. One of the strongest arguments for raising crickets and other insects for food is their ability to survive on waste streams. But in the study, the groups that ate only unprocessed waste died before they could be harvested. The researchers also found that when crickets were reared in close quarters, conditions that mimic potential industrial production, the critters' protein conversion efficiency dropped. Cricket farmers say the study focused too much on food that crickets don't eat, and when comparing chicken farming to bug farming, did not take into account ecological advantages such as lower greenhouse gas emissions and the lack of antibiotics and hormones in insect farming. Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie for our news updates. Read more from them and share these stories. Access them at eartheats.org.
We talk about food stories like these all the time on Twitter. Let us know what you think, at Earth Eats. Lou Ann Johnson, thanks.
You bet.
For decades, food companies have been deliberately bumping up the salt, sugar, and fat levels in processed foods in order to make us crave them. And those unhealthy foods have played a big part in our current epidemic of health problems, including obesity and diabetes. So argues Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Moss in his book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat: How the Food Giants Got Us Hooked. Harvest Public Media's Alex Smith caught up with Moss recently.
Now, we're in a part of the country that produces a lot of corn syrup, which is now a big part of our diets. How has our diet changed the way that we use the land and the way agriculture operates?
So the last time I looked, some 90 million acres in this country are being planted in field corn, perhaps soybean as well, versus 5 million for all fruits and vegetables. I mean, that's one sort of huge change in the landscape. And interesting, a year ago for the Times, I did stories about corn farmers, field corn farmers, who were switching over to fruits and vegetables, because it turns out you can actually, per acre, make a lot more money growing apples or broccoli or spinach. The key, though, the challenge is how to market that thing. So the other thing that sort of happened is that there's an incredibly powerful marketing transport system for field corn that doesn't exist for that Kansas or Illinois farmer who wants to grow apples. So they have to, you know, they're working on developing marketing systems for fruits and vegetables like that. So I think we're starting to see a very slow change in that regard. But your question goes to, field corn and soybeans has come to dominate American agriculture as staples in highly processed foods.
So what role does agriculture play in that shift? I mean, have farmers and agribusiness been providing what food manufacturers demand, or have they been sort of steering that change as well?
I mean, I think so far responding to what food manufacturers want, and there's sort of a heavy influence, I think, in terms of agricultural education and resources, and the amount of money that goes into research and development. Again, the last time I looked, it was some $2 billion every year is spent on looking for ways to make field corn and soybeans more productive, more profitable for farmers. And the last time I looked, you know, the number for fruits and vegetables was down at 100 million for all fruits and vegetables in terms of research and development, making them more productive, more profitable. So this imbalance, I think this is a structural imbalance here that weighs heavily in the favor of field corn and soybeans and against sort of fruits and vegetables.
Food makers and, you know, just anyone who produces products for consumers tries to make what they produce as appealing as possible to consumers. What responsibility do food makers have to the American public, to eaters in general?
I think their policy up until now has always been, look, we make what people want. And if they want more whole grains in the product, or if they want lower fat or high sugar, we'll try to give them that. But the bottom line is, we can't put products on the grocery shelf that people won't buy. We will go out of business. So we have to respond to consumer demand. But in the last few months, I think we've seen a real turn in terms of shoppers acting on their desire to eat healthier. You're seeing one large food company after another report just horrible earnings reports to Wall Street, and they are all now scrambling to figure out ways to make healthier versions of their products. And one of the things they're up against is that they have become so reliant on using lots of salt, sugar, fat for lots of reasons, not just to make their products really attractive and alluring, that they're finding it really difficult to cut back on those in meaningful ways and or substitute in better ingredients.
Michael Moss, thank you for your time.
Thanks for talking to me and your interest.
Michael Moss is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with Harvest Public Media's Alex Smith. Later today, we get an update from Harvest on the outbreak of avian flu on Midwestern poultry farms. Now a look at how local residents are affecting change in Bloomington's food scene. On April 1st, the Bloomington, Indiana City Council unanimously approved a new food charter that's intended to help guide community decisions about policies and programs that affect the local food system. The charter was written by the Bloomington Food Policy Council, and it was 10 years in the making. Stephanie Solomon says a decade ago, when the group first formed, there were plenty of players working in specific areas of the food system.
But there wasn't a great way to come together and collaborate around policies that have, you know, a big impact on our food system.
So they started having meetings. People from nonprofits, students from Indiana University, growers, lawmakers. Michael Simmons is the chair of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. He says those initial get-togethers focused on two questions.
One of which was, what would be the interest in the community in including more local food in our retail establishments, restaurants, and grocery stores? And two, what were some of the constraints on doing that? It was out of that conversation that the idea and the reality of the Food Policy Council arose.
Simmons and Solomon joined me in the Earth Eats studios to talk about the new food charter. I'm sure the food climate in this area has changed over the last 10 years. Can you highlight some ways we've gotten better, some ways the food system maybe has taken some steps backwards?
Well, I think in terms of what has happened positively, we've had an increased interest in people growing their own food. And that has shown itself in the numbers of people who are taking classes in how to grow food, also in attendance at the farmers market. And we've begun to see in some of the major retail stores signs appearing that say local cantaloupe. So I think that there's a growing awareness of the interest in local food, and I think that's a very positive step.
I've seen my pet passion is community gardening, and I've watched as community gardening over the past 10 years has really boomed. I know that the city sells out of their plots every year and often has a waiting list, and there's more and more folks that are growing their own food at home, whether it's in containers or, you know, backyard or front yard gardens. But then at the same time, and I'm coming from, you know, the social service sector, I've worked with Mother Hubbard's Cupboard for about 8 years now, and there's been a consistent growth in need for food assistance. And so food, I think, is a really great way, like a great lens to look at some of the bigger issues that our community is facing.
So let's talk specifically about a couple points that really stuck out to me. Help make farming a viable vocational option by honoring farmers, providing opportunities for agricultural education, and removing barriers to land acquisition by new farmers. What most struck me was the phrase honoring farmers. Mm-hmm. Talk about why you included that in the charter.
Well, I mean, I think that we live in a culture that doesn't – I mean – I would say the same thing kind of about public education. Like there are some really important players that kind of keep us going and keep our communities functioning. And farmers are an essential part of any strong community, especially farmers that are, you know, using sustainable methods and growing on, you know, smaller scale. If we, you know, if we want to expand to all these larger markets, we're going to need the farmers and the land and the infrastructure to do that.
Were you seeing something in the community about farmers being disrespected that you felt like we needed to raise this profession up?
I think that is the case. When I was administering the community gardens for Bloomington Parks and Recreation, we created the Crestmont Community Garden with a USDA Food Project grant. And the purpose of the garden was to teach horticultural skills to residents in the Crestmont community with the idea that they would be able to increase their own nutritional intake and at the same time earn some marketable skills. One of the things that we had not anticipated was an aversion to working the land on the part of people who were not that far removed from rural communities and who saw going back to farming as a step backward in their progress towards a more modern lifestyle. So I think there is some stigma still attached to the farming life, and it's one that we need to overcome.
More food literacy, that's another thing that we talk about in the food charter, how food is being produced, who is producing it. I think building food literacy requires that recognition of the important role that farmers play.
I think, too, there has been a change in the teaching of farming that is encouraging. Purdue University has a group of faculty who are turning more towards a sustainable model of agriculture and are attracting more young people who are really interested in farming on a smaller scale in a sustainable way. And I think that, you know, once our land-grant universities are on board with that kind of education and encouragement for young farmers, we'll have a much easier time recruiting new farmers, which is what we really need to do.
Michael Simmons, and Stephanie Solomon of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. More next week about the food charter and how to get more local food into big box grocery stores. Chef Daniel Orr spends a lot of time at his mom's house near Columbus, Indiana. It's beautiful there. The lake is down a hill in the backyard. There's a huge garden in the front yard, a couple beehives on their land as well. He often brings employees from the restaurant there to relax and have a little fun.
We had a great barbecue down by the lake, and then we all jumped in the boat and we went over to Mary Wineland's house and picked all of her sour cherries off her tree.
Did she know you were coming?
She even had the buckets and the ladders out for us. She gives us the cherries every year, and then I, in exchange, give her some of this sour cherry syrup, and then on 4th of July, I take her a sour cherry cobbler.
We'll see if we can convince Chef to make us a sour cherry cobbler later in the summer. But on hot May days, there's nothing quite like a cold drink. So this big bucket of cherries is going to be transformed into some sour cherry syrup that he'll combine with ice and club soda.
So we're going to take a cup of water, 2 cups of granulated sugar, 1/4 cup of honey, juice of 1 lemon, and 2 pounds of fruit. So in this case, sour cherries. And what we do is we bring that all to a boil, and these cherries were pitted first. Just one boil, and then puree it in the blender, and you've got this wonderful deep red elixir. Mix that about equal parts. We've got the sour cherry, just drizzle it over the ice. We're going to top it with some club soda, and then, you know, you could drop a sour cherry in there, or you could, in this case, I've got a few currants. And you've got a really pretty drink that's delicious as well.
Use blackberries or gooseberries with this same preparation. There is sugar and honey in this recipe. Since you're making it from scratch, you can determine just how much sweetener you put in. Adjust according to your tastes. That's what Daniel always says. He's got another drink recipe for us in the second half of the show.
You think about having these around race time, but as it gets hotter in the summertime, I've decided to turn it into a frozen drink.
This one's for adults only. Stay with us to hear what he whips up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Annie Corrigan with you. It's farmers market season. Throughout the summer, we'll be airing conversations with farmers and producers. I stopped by the Paget Family Farm Table in early April. They make the trek from eastern Greene County, Indiana, every Saturday morning to sell at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market. Jeff Paget has all types of meat for sale today. Grass-fed beef, pastured pork, some eggs as well. He says his cows spend most of their time on pasture.
They've got a good life. They won the lottery.
And how are things going so far on the farm? Well, Jeff has been noticing that things seem to be running about 2 weeks later than usual.
Although the pastures are coming on just fine. You know, the grass will grow any day that the temperature's over 50 degrees and the sun's shining. So it's really starting to perk up. Trying to let the grass grow a good root system before we start moving them around. It helps, especially if we get a dry period.
Moving them around, he means they practice rotational grazing with their hens, heritage hogs, and cattle. So hardy, healthy grass is one of the most valuable assets on the Padgett's farm.
We move them either every 12 or 24 hours to a different paddock once we start moving them, and then they won't go back to that paddock for hopefully at least 28 days. The grass is more nutritious for the cows that way, and it's just better for the pastures too.
Jeff Padgett, who's been setting up a table at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market since 1996. If you're looking for a market near you, connect with our Twitter feed. We'll post a link to the FDA's Farmers Markets directory there. Find us at twitter.com/EarthEats. The waiting and seeing stages is now over for poultry and egg producers across the Midwest. They began 2015 on high alert for bird flu. But now farms in many states, including Iowa, Missouri, and Kansas, are dealing with an active outbreak. Nationwide, more than 100 locations have been infected. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has this look at the disaster response.
When bird flu hits, the immediate needs are to contain it and prevent its spread.
A rapid response is extremely important in an infectious disease outbreak like this.
That's Jim Roth, head of the Center for Food Safety and Public Health at Iowa State's Veterinary College. This outbreak is massive. The strain isn't dangerous to humans, but officials want to contain it, so it stays that way.
But this one has spread more broadly than I certainly anticipated, and most people didn't anticipate it would spread this fast to so many premises.
Roth explains that when the highly contagious strain of bird flu is found, the state, here it's the Iowa Department of Agriculture, issues a quarantine for the area within a 6-mile radius.
The officials then have to find all of the poultry in that area and check every flock, backyard flocks and commercial flocks.
It's a huge undertaking. In Iowa, it can mean millions of birds. And it means federal and state agencies have to work together. They test eggs daily to keep any infected ones out of grocery stores. Beyond containing the virus, there's another huge challenge: disposing of all those dead birds. On a positive farm, any birds not killed from infection have to be euthanized. Bill Aim of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources says despite disaster planning, this outbreak has hit harder than expected.
I'm not sure that we had fully considered the implications of this number of mortalities in this type of a layer operation where it is so concentrated.
Ames says there are four basic ways to manage disposal: on-site burial, enclosed composting within a shed, incineration, and landfills.
I don't think any one of these things is going to be sufficient to handle any one of these large operations.
Farms will need to use multiple options, and AIM points out that regulators will have to consider the environmental impacts, such as air pollution from burning in a kiln or water contamination from burial. After such a giant outbreak, researchers are trying to determine what else they could possibly do to prevent another. Hongwei Shin is a professor and head of the Egg Industry Center at Iowa State. He says the infected farms were following required biosecurity protocols, including showering in and out of barns and donning protective coveralls and boots before entering. And that suggests these may not be enough.
So now is to the point that we say, well, maybe we should be looking closer about the air.
Shin says previously barn ventilation systems weren't thought to be a likely point of entry. Now they're reconsidering.
This thing could potentially be transmitted through particular matter in the air that's carried, you know, into the ventilation space, into the barn.
Looking ahead, biologists will monitor migrating birds nationwide this fall in an effort to better understand how the avian flu virus is traveling. Here in the Midwest, researchers are hopeful this is the worst outbreak they'll face. But when temperatures dip again after the summer, poultry will be as vulnerable as ever. Veterinarian Jim Roth says we may need to prepare a vaccine for this strain of bird flu. But that's expensive, and administering it is labor-intensive.
So vaccine isn't a solution that we would want to go to quickly, only as if we really needed to, because so many flocks are infected, we can't control it, or it threatens our food supply.
Roth and others are already thinking about the lessons learned that will emerge from this outbreak and hoping they won't have a need to apply them. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More stories about food and farming from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. And another trip into the kitchen with Daniel Orr. This time he's got the bourbon out for an adult beverage. Mint juleps. Here we go.
And you think about having these around race time, but as it gets hotter in the summertime, I've decided to turn it into a frozen drink. So we're going to do frozen mint juleps today. All right, so got some great mint out of the garden, and we're going to take off most of the stem. And what we want is that real nice green color. It's going to be a real bright, vibrant kind of chartreuse color. So we're just going to pick really about as much mint as you can put in this blender. We're going to put probably a cup of loosely packed mint leaves. Okay, then I've made some simple syrup, and we've done syrups before on Earth Eats. It's equal parts sugar and water. For two people, we add about a third of a cup. We're going to put about an equal part of bourbon. Now, you don't want to use your really good bourbon because the mint's going to cover up all the subtleties of the aging process and the barrel aging and all that. So, you know, not exactly rot gut, but one step above. And now we're going to put a squeeze of a full lime. And really, you want to squeeze it out, get all that juice and get that pith in there. And then one thing that I like to do is to go ahead and just cut off a little bit of that lime zest and throw that in there. And it's going to be a little bit chunky when we puree it with the ice cubes, but it tastes so good to bite into those little pieces of zest. All right, so we've got all of our ingredients there. We're going to top it off with some ice. Put it on the machine, and here we go. All right, and we've got these pretty glasses. These are old Southern iced tea glasses.
Cheers.
Since you are adding a bit of zest to this drink, Chef D says you should absolutely buy an organic lime, locally grown, if possible, and be sure to give it a good wash, too. All right, this recipe and the recipe for the non-alcoholic sour cherry fizz are both at eartheats.org. Earth Eats is what it is because of our team, Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and the crew at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. It's a good day when you join us. Thanks for spending some time with Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.